Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and live longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Today, we'll be talking about the role of nutrition, exercise, and mind-body interventions for breast cancer. And I'm joined by Dr. Amy Commander, who's a breast oncologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. She is Director of Breast Oncology and Cancer Survivorship at the Mass General Cancer Center in Waltham and at Newton Wellesley Hospital, and Medical Director of Mass General Cancer Center in Waltham. Dr. Commander is Director of Lifestyle Medicine at the Mass General Cancer Center, which is the first cancer center to have a dedicated lifestyle medicine program. Given her strong interest in cancer survivorship and lifestyle medicine, Dr. Commander is dedicated to improving the quality of life, well-being, and outcome of individuals with cancer through important lifestyle interventions, including exercise, diet, and mind-body interventions. She promotes healthy lifestyles for both her active treatment patients as well as those in survivorship phase of care. She practices what she preaches, having run marathons, including 10 consecutive Boston marathons so far, with a goal to improve the lives of those with a diagnosis of cancer. Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so honored to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. So, Amy, tell us a little bit more about what you do, like how you combine breast oncology with survivorship, and what your work looks like.
Thank you for asking. So, you know, my day-to-day job is that I'm a breast oncologist at the Mass General Cancer Center, which means my primary role is to see patients who are either at increased risk for breast cancer for various reasons, maybe a genetic cause, strong family history, or other factors. But primarily, I see patients newly diagnosed with any stage of breast cancer. I meet with them and their families and formulate a treatment plan. And as you know from your introduction, I'm also very interested in optimizing health and outcome after a diagnosis of breast cancer with a focus on the important role of lifestyle interventions.
So when you see a patient who's been diagnosed, you manage the oncology portion, the chemotherapy, and recommend that route of care and adjunct that with the lifestyle medicine interventions to have the best outcome?
Absolutely. So I do want to emphasize, you know, of course, we strongly believe in the important role of our treatments, whether that's endocrine therapy, such as tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors, chemotherapy, targeted therapies. Now we're using immunotherapy in certain cases. And of course, we're really excited about our clinical trials where we get to test new agents in cancer. But along with that standard treatment, I'm very interested in collaborating with my colleagues, both at the Mass General Cancer Center and, of course, around the world, on learning about how we can also apply tools from lifestyle medicine to optimize the outcome for our patients. And we both know that increasing data, it's demonstrating the important role of these interventions in oncology care.
Yeah, Amy, so you must be pretty unique nationally. I know in my experience referring patients to breast oncologists, a lot certainly focus on the chemotherapy and, as you said, the hormonal treatments for just treating the cancer. And a lot of patients are increasingly interested in the lifestyle medicine portion, you know, how to eat, exercise, et cetera, to improve, you know, how they feel as they're being treated as well as their outcomes. But for a lot of my patients, it's different providers, not the same person counseling on both. And it's pretty unique to have expertise in both. Are there other programs across the country doing this?
Well, I would say my patients are the ones who taught me the importance of getting educated in this area and learning how to talk about the role of weight loss after treatment, how to optimize sleep. What does the data show about nutrition after cancer? As we know, our patients are very educated and ask all these questions in our visits. And I did find myself early on when I started out as a breast oncologist, not really knowing what to say to some of these questions, because as we know, we don't learn a lot of this in medical school or through our medical training. And honestly, that is how I found lifestyle medicine, really by a flyer advertising a Harvard Medical School conference that was being held at MGH, like on a weekend in June. And I was like, wow, I should actually go to this conference and learn something so I can provide appropriate information to my own patients. And of course, I wanted to learn for myself because I'm a runner as a hobby and I'm vegetarian. So I just thought, wow, this is up my alley. But you're absolutely right. As you know, no matter what your specialty, a lot of us unfortunately did not have adequate training in these tools. And therefore, as an oncologist, I've really enjoyed diving into the literature and learning about how to properly counsel my patients about diet, exercise, sleep management, stress management, etc.
Yeah. And another way I think what you're doing is incredibly unique is you're so well positioned to look at the outcomes from the lifestyle interventions. Because, you know, a lot of times people get information from various sources, maybe do green smoothies and read about things that they should be including in their diet. But to actually have the data and to blend it with the care that you're providing is pretty incredible. I mean, I think that you are very unique in what you do because you are combining both the counseling on both ends and getting data and outcomes. So pretty amazing. I'm loving to have this conversation because I think what you can provide is so data driven.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. I mean, we know in this era of social media, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and now Threads, our patients are going all over the place to find information. And it's really hard, I think, as a patient to know, is this person who's providing this information about the latest green smoothie and supplement on Instagram, what is that person's credentials? Maybe they actually sound really good and speak very eloquently on that reel or whatever it is, but how do our patients really discern what is true information versus misinformation? So I think it is really important as doctors that we help provide this evidence-based information. And that's something that I'm really working hard to do as well in the cancer world.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's very needed. So I want to jump into some of the things that you counsel your patients on. So when you see a patient that, say, is recently diagnosed with breast cancer, and they're very interested in blending lifestyle medicine, where do you begin?
Such a great question. And we know our patients, a patient who's just received a diagnosis of breast cancer, it's very, very scary and often overwhelming in so many ways and causing great stress and anxiety. So certainly, I want all of our patients to know, and anyone listening who has a diagnosis of breast cancer, no one should ever feel guilty that something they did potentially caused this cancer. They should never feel, oh, I didn't exercise enough, or I drank too much, or I ate too much red meat. I would never want anyone to feel that way. So as I often say, and I've learned this from my colleague, Dr. Frates, there is no shame, no blame, and no guilt. But after a diagnosis of cancer or sometimes other major medical events, often our patients use that as kind of a wake up, like, wow, this just happened to me. Now, what tools can I use to help improve my health going forward? And often our patients feel that way and they want to learn. And therefore, I try to work with my patients wherever they may be. Maybe they never exercised. Maybe they're interested in adopting more of a plant predominant diet. Where are they starting from and how can we help them make these changes? And, you know, just thinking about all the pillars of lifestyle medicine, each of them have a key role for our cancer survivor population. But if you ask me, where do I start? Probably the easiest place to start where we do have good data in the oncology space is the important role of physical activity. So that's often something I ask all of my patients at a first visit, what do you do for exercise, just to get a sense of what they do. And then that's a nice place to start working with someone on some of these behavior changes.
That's so interesting you say that, Amy. So when you look at data, the data on exercise, you would say is stronger than the nutrition data?
Well, I think they're all important. I mean, certainly the nutrition data is so key as well, and really helping our patients achieve a healthy body weight. That's like really important, particularly for our breast cancer survivor population. And that's actually what got me interested in lifestyle medicine in the first place. Many of our patients perhaps are overweight at the time of diagnosis, or they also gain weight during the course of their treatment, whether it's related to their chemotherapy or their endocrine therapy or other factors. So helping my patients get back to a healthy body weight was really what got me into lifestyle medicine in the first place. So certainly counseling our patients about body weight is important, but often physical activity and nutrition, I should say, are good places to start.
And I only ask that because I think a lot of people really drill down on food, what to eat, what not to eat. And I feel like exercise gets kind of a secondary role. And just even equating the two in terms of their importance, I don't think gets said enough. I think it gets drowned out by nutrition information. When you counsel people on exercise, is there a certain amount type that you think is more prescriptive related to breast cancer?
Sure. First of all, another reason I do think exercise is so important for our patients going through chemotherapy is data by Dr. Katie Schmitz and other colleagues shows that those individuals who can remain physically active during treatment tolerate chemotherapy better, less incidence of needing to dose reduce their treatment, which then ultimately results often in better outcomes. So physical activity during treatment and beyond is so important. But in terms of the recommendations that you're asking about, we do have guidelines from organizations such as the American College of Sports Medicine, and of course, the American Cancer Society, American Institute of Cancer Research, and American Society of Clinical Oncology, my organization. And there are very clear guidelines that the goal, really the minimum, is similar to what you would probably counsel your patients about, 150 minutes of moderate aerobic activity each week, and getting in that strength training ideally twice a week. And that's really hard for a lot of people, 150 minutes. I try to explain that that doesn't mean that you have to do a dedicated like 30-minute workout session 5 days a week. Sometimes that could be walking in your neighborhood, getting your mail, 10 minutes, three times a day, and trying to add it up to 150 minutes. There's different creative approaches we know to get to that number. But that is very challenging for many individuals, especially those going through treatment. So we meet the patient where they are and help them get there, but it's definitely a challenge. And I'm sure you would agree as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think so many people are at different starting points. And I think it's just a very hard time to start something when you haven't been doing it before because there are so many other factors. And some people just don't feel well when they're getting treatment as well. When you mentioned that quality of life, how people go through the treatments is improved. So when people exercise versus not exercise, what are differences that you would see?
Right. So exercise has been shown to have so many benefits, certainly for our breast cancer population, which we can focus on for now. We know that physical activity helps improve cancer-related fatigue, which is actually the number one symptom that many of our patients experience. Exercise can reduce risk of lymphedema, which is a complication that can happen after surgery and radiation where a woman might develop swelling of her arm. Exercise can improve treatment tolerance, improve mood, reduce anxiety, improve stress, obviously help with body composition and weight management. I can go on and on. But one of the coolest things about exercise in my field is this whole emerging field called exercise oncology. And if I was starting out again, I would become an exercise oncologist, and maybe I still will. So what does that mean? You know, there's so many great scientists around the world really trying to understand the biology, like what is happening in a tumor when we exercise, because there's data now showing that exercise after a cancer diagnosis, such as breast cancer, has been shown to ultimately reduce risk of recurrence and improve outcome from breast cancer. So there you go. That's amazing. And at a biologic level, what is happening? You know, our muscles release these myokines, which potentially act on so many pathways and perhaps around a tumor to reduce cell death, apoptosis, maybe augment the immune system. There's so many fascinating mechanisms that are being uncovered. And when I explain that to a patient and show them information about the potential role of exercise and actually as a treatment for their breast cancer, that really makes a major impression. It helps that patient feel motivated to why exercise is so important.
That's so interesting you say that, Amy. There's also a lot of interest now in the metabolic aspects of cancer, and cancer is a metabolic disease, and how exercise can help, you know, at the level of the mitochondria, et cetera. Do you delve into the mechanisms and kind of help that explain to people why it's important?
You're absolutely right. We know, you know, we've talked about overweight obesity. Now we're talking about metabolic mechanisms as well. We know that potentially does exercise help reduce inflammation or modulate insulin resistance, augment your immune system? Like there's so many potential mechanisms that are being uncovered in this field of exercise oncology. And so I do think this is like a new frontier that we're learning more and more about. Every time I go to an oncology meeting, I definitely seek out those talks to see what the scientists are uncovering. But I think this is definitely of great interest, certainly to oncologists and to our patients.
Yeah, it's incredibly fascinating. I think it changes the way we view cancer as a disease.
Definitely. In fact, actually, I'm on an email list about exercise and oncology. Of course I am. And actually, right before this podcast, I received an email. I can't remember the exact authors for this study, but I believe it was in Nature, showing that short bursts of exercise in individuals with breast cancer they actually drew the blood like after a 10-minute bout of exercise and shown an increase in leukocytes, as you know, white blood cells. And they specifically looked at the types of white blood cells and saw an increase in natural killer cells and certain subtypes of T cells. And so it's postulated that this short burst of exercise can really cause an increase in leukocytes and potentially provide a mechanism for how exercise can augment the immune response to cancer. So again, there's so much going on in the research in this area, and it's really exciting and so interesting.
Love that information, because really tying together just how profoundly and how many levels exercise helps our immune system, which fights cancer. It helps our metabolic system and the role of how we metabolize sugars and fats and how that plays a role in cancer. It's really just changing how we're viewing the management, right? In terms of how profound these interventions are.
I mean, just one exciting note I mentioned earlier, ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, came out last year with a new guideline focused on diet, weight management, and exercise during cancer treatment. You know, it's a very evidence-based guideline looking at all these meta-analyses. Many researchers met to create this guideline. And some of the recommendations, you know, they're like, there needs to be more research. We need more data. But the one clear recommendation was that cancer patients should be counseled on the role of exercise during treatment. So that was a clear statement, and that really makes a major impression. And I think it's really a wake-up call for all oncologists and cancer centers throughout the world that we need to provide exercise counseling to our patients and provide these resources. And I can honestly tell you, it's very challenging. You know, I'm at the Mass General Cancer Center, and we do have a number of resources, but we really need more. And many of our patients don't have access to places to exercise, or they don't really know what to do or how to start. So this is really an area that I think I need for great improvement.
Yeah. And, you know, I think for all of us in daily practice, there's a limited amount of time, and most of, you know, the priority goes to managing the treatment plan for the cancer. And then beyond that, like you said, if we don't have a system that allows and supports the kind of work that it, you know, you need to do to make sure it's a very holistic approach, it's very challenging. So I imagine across the country, even though the guideline recognizes the importance of it, the actual implementation is quite challenging and probably doesn't happen nearly as often as we would hope that it would.
Right. It's absolutely true. And thankfully, in this new virtual world that we're in, there are so many options that our patients can take advantage of online or virtual exercise classes. But again, many times patients will tell me, I just don't know where to start, or is it safe for me to get started, or I'm worried about lymphedema. So there really is a need to provide specific counseling for our cancer patient population so they feel comfortable.
And Amy, if a person listening to this doesn't have access to an oncologist that is familiar with how to guide the nutrition and exercise aspects, I know you've created a course, a program, Paving the Path to Wellness, and a workbook. Can people access what you've created, and how would they do that?
Thank you for asking. So again, when I went to that Lifestyle Medicine conference many years ago, I was very fortunate to meet Dr. Beth Frates at the conference. She was an amazing speaker, as she always is. And also, she was one of the course directors. And afterwards, I went up to her and I'm like, hi, I'm an oncologist. I'd love to meet with you to discuss how I can start a weight loss program for my patients. So that's what I was interested in the beginning. And that's when she really introduced me to the multifaceted aspects of lifestyle medicine and how weight loss is not just diet and exercise, right? There's many facets to it, talking about sleep and stress management. Again, all the pillars of lifestyle medicine that we know and love. And at that point, she told me about this paving program that she had started for stroke survivors. She was working with that population at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, which is a Harvard Medical School affiliated hospital. And she was like, why don't we work together and you can adapt it for a breast cancer survivor population. And actually, that's what I did. And it took me some time, but with her encouragement, I got it going. And I will say that it's a labor of love and I truly enjoy doing it. It's a 12-week program for breast cancer survivors and thrivers, as they call themselves, where we really focus on the six pillars of lifestyle medicine, but also include goal setting, sense of purpose, the role of investigations, trying new things, variety. You get the idea. So it's a lot of fun. And I will say that one key aspect, as we've been discussing today, is encouraging our patients to learn about physical activity. What does the science say? Why is it important for breast cancer survivors? How that actually implemented. So we spend a lot of time. In fact, that's the first session, but we probably talk about it every single time over those 12 weeks. So in collaboration with Dr. Frates and Dr. Michelle Tollefson, who I was fortunate to meet through her and through the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, we now have a nonprofit called Paving the Path to Wellness, and the website is pavingwellness.org. So there, your listeners could learn more about the paving program, and I hope in the future to be able to offer a program for breast cancer survivors through the nonprofit so individuals from all over can join and learn and take part. And I know there's so much interest in this, so I'm really excited to help spread this knowledge since it's so important.
That's fantastic. So that's pavingwellness.org.
Yes. And we also wrote a book. I have to say that too. So if someone's like, give me the book, I want to read. And we know, again, our patients love to learn and get well educated. So we did write a book, Paving the Path to Wellness. It's a workbook that's currently available on Amazon and Healthy Learning, that website. And it really goes through each of the six pillars of lifestyle medicine, plus the other six steps that we cover in the paving program. And I should say all proceeds go to the nonprofit. I just want to say that. It's all supporting a nonprofit so we can spread this knowledge to all individuals, including underserved communities. But it's a great way for someone who's listening, who wants to learn more, to get more, just to kind of hunker down at the book and read. And it's a workbook, so there's lots of questions. And so it makes it kind of interactive and fun.
And when people incorporate exercise, is there data on the effect that has on survivorship?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many interesting studies. I should cite one that I actually just came across, which is also, I know all these great things come out all the time. We got to stay on top of it, right? But the paper was entitled Adherence to Cancer Prevention Lifestyle Recommendations Before, During, and 2 years after treatment for high-risk breast cancer. And this was just published in JAMA Network Open in May of 2023. And this study was a prospective cohort study of about 1,300 patients with higher-risk breast cancer. And they looked at these individuals and how well they adhered to recommendations from the American Cancer Society and American Institute of Cancer Research in terms of lifestyle behaviors, which include physical activity, eating lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, limiting red meat, limiting sugar sweetened beverages, limiting alcohol, et cetera, looking at all those factors and then following them again at different time points, you know, the time of diagnosis, during treatment, and 2 years after. And those individuals who adhered the most to these basic lifestyle recommendations that we're both so passionate about did have a reduced risk of breast cancer recurrence and reduced risk of dying from breast cancer. So these lifestyle interventions are very powerful, even in our higher risk patients who did adhere to standard treatment as well. I want to acknowledge that the standard treatment is absolutely key.
Did the article cite any specifics on what's the magnitude?
So basically in that particular study, there was a 37% reduced hazard of breast cancer recurrence, 58% reduced hazard of mortality in this population. Again, it's a prospective cohort study, so it's not like a randomized trial. We have to acknowledge that. But in this particular study, that's those who were able to adhere the most to these basic lifestyle recommendations, which we talk about with our patients all the time. Limit your alcohol, limit the red meat, try to get in that physical activity, and then, you know, survey them at these different time points. So again, this is so powerful. And so we know it's just so important as an oncologist and my nurse practitioner colleagues, who I'm so fortunate to work with, all of the members of our team, it's so key that we counsel our patients about these very basic things they can do that will help improve their outcome, in addition to taking their tamoxifen and doing their chemotherapy and whatever other recommendations we need to tell them to discuss with them as part of their standard cancer treatment.
Those numbers are huge.
Yeah. I mean, I was reviewing that study and I was also like very impressed. Again, I should say the follow-up, it was the last assessment visit 2 years. So of course, with breast cancer, especially estrogen-sensitive breast cancers, we do always want longer follow-up. Estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, which is the most common subtype of breast cancer, those patients, you know, we follow them, we continue to follow them clinic 10 years and beyond. So, you know, ongoing follow-up, which I'm sure they will do in this study, is absolutely key. But you're absolutely right. Those numbers are very impressive. And so really makes a big impression. And this is the type of data we should be sharing with our patients.
And Amy, for the exercise piece, you said target the 150 minutes per week of moderate to, you know, intensity, and then weight resistance twice a week. For the nutrition part, what are rough parameters to optimize outcomes?
I love the recommendations on the American Institute of Cancer Research website, evidence-based. Again, when you come to nutrition, it's the Wild West out there. One of my patients said that to me yesterday. It's the Wild West. I was like, yes. So go to the AICR site. There are 10 cancer prevention recommendations. And I know for a breast cancer patient, she's like, hello, I already have breast cancer. But this is also appropriate for cancer survivors. And they really are clear about the importance of physical activity. And then when it comes to nutrition, AICR really focuses on diet quality. And I love that, the quality of the diet, a diet that is abundant in whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables. Let's limit the fast foods, limit the added sugars. Let's avoid those ultra-processed foods, which we know we should not be consuming anyway. Let's limit the red meat, no processed meats. Again, limiting alcohol consumption, ideally no alcohol consumption. The guidelines are very clear on their site, and there's recipes and articles and references. So that's why I often tell my patients that's a great place to start if they're looking for evidence-based information about nutrition.
And the question of soy always comes up. Estrogen positive cancer and soy intake. What are your thoughts on that?
So our patients ask about that too. And unfortunately, it is a very prevalent myth that soy consumption is bad for breast cancer survivors. And the data actually would suggest the opposite. For those who eat, again, thinking about a whole foods approach, edamame, tofu in limited quantities, soy milk, et cetera, limited consumption of soy is actually okay. And in some studies, individuals who consume soy at a young age have been shown to later to have a lower risk of breast cancer. So soy consumption is okay. I just counsel my patients about avoiding some of these like ultra processed versions of soy or soy protein isolate and protein powders and things like that. But thinking about these other foods, we do think they are safe. And definitely I tell my patients that too. You know, tofu is an edamame are great plant-based sources of protein. So I certainly want to encourage them to take advantage of that.
And beyond the diet and exercise piece, what are other foundational things that people should be doing?
You know, as I've been doing the PAVIAN program, you learn so much about so many aspects of lifestyle medicine that are challenging for our patients. For example, insomnia and other types of sleep disturbance are present in over 50% of cancer survivors. And we know how important sleep is for our health. More and more research is emerging that demonstrates that. So that's a key aspect in the PAVIAN program, how to counsel our cancer survivors about sleep. And I'm fortunate to work with a great colleague, Dr. Daniel Hall, who's doing a lot of research regarding the role of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia in cancer survivors. So he comes, speaks to our group, shares resources. So that's one area that's so important. Stress management, so important. We know, obviously, there's probably not much more stressful than getting a diagnosis of cancer. So our patients very much experience stress, anxiety, and other mood challenges after their diagnosis during their treatment as survivors. Fear of recurrence is very prevalent. And as we know, excessive stress can lead to other unhealthy behavior. So it's really important for us to provide strategies for our patients to address stress and these other aspects of their, that can affect their mood. So the, all of these things are areas that we very much focus out in our program, and or I refer to other colleagues of mine who can help my patients address these issues.
Do you make all the interventions to help around stress more mind-body activities? Do you recommend medications in certain situations? Like, is there a value for people? I certainly have a lot of patients, like you said, recently diagnosed where the anxiety is just so high that they have trouble doing mind-body interventions in a way that's effectively managing their stress. Is there a role for medication?
Definitely. I mean, many of our patients often see either a psychiatry colleague or I will prescribe these medications to help with excessive anxiety or depression, which, you know, are very prevalent in cancer survivors. So those interventions certainly play a key role. We fortunately, at my cancer center, I'm lucky we have this dedicated stress management and resiliency program through the Benson Henry Mind-Body Institute specifically for cancer survivors. But of course, I recognize that not everyone has access to something like that. So thankfully, there are many options available. Many of them are free. You know, all these apps such as Headspace, Calm, Insight Timer that teach how to do meditation. I'm still working on that one, by the way. I do love it when I do it, but I need to learn how to make that more of a habit for myself. But certainly many of my patients derive great benefit from using those tools. And of course, you know, exercise can help address stress. Sleeping well is important. So as you know, all of these aspects of lifestyle medicine are so intertwined.
And Amy, what part of what you tell your patients is the most surprising to them? In terms of, I imagine some people have a sense that if they make some lifestyle changes, they may have a better outcome with the treatment. And then the recurrence piece, I'm just curious if people are surprised to learn that they can impact recurrence.
Right. I think, you know, this data we're talking about showing the benefits of, let's just use exercise as an example, like explaining to a patient that, you know, scientists are putting little mice and rats on treadmills who have cancer, and then like learning about the biology of what's going on in terms of a tumor after exercise that actually has either showing anti-cancer effects. So amazing. I know we were talking before about our majors in college. This is right up your alley. So like, what is the actual mechanism by which exercise is providing this benefit for a tumor? And I think our patients are fascinated by this. And actually, you know, it's not like people know about that unless they're a doctor or maybe they watched a documentary about it. But like, I think that's an area that I think my patients find so interesting. But also, you know, there's data about alcohol not being good for cancer. And I don't think that message, we all need as a medical community need to do a better job getting that message out that alcohol definitely increases risk for cancer. It's not a health, there's no health halo, you know what I mean? So I think there's so many aspects, again, in getting back to the sort of misinformation or like lack of appropriate information, we need to do a good job communicating these things.
Amy, with the time we have left, is there anything that you would like to share with people listening that you wish all patients who either have been diagnosed with breast cancer or know somebody with breast cancer, that you wish people just knew and what you think may make a big difference in their lives?
Right. I just realized one of the most important pillars of lifestyle medicine we didn't get a chance to touch on. And I didn't realize this one was number one until I started doing the PAVING program. And that is social connection. So when I started my PAVING program, my goal, as you can see, Sharon, was like, I'm going to provide this evidence-based information about exercise and nutrition and sleep and stress and alcohol, and my patients are going to be so informed and they're going to love it. But guess what? What they really loved was being in a group with other women with a diagnosis of breast cancer with similar challenges and fears. They bonded, they made friends, they found new buddies to go walking with. And when the program, the first program ended in the fall of 2019, they were like, Dr. Commander, we're not done. We are continuing to pave our path to wellness. They're like this. Those ladies in that first group, they're called the originals. And so therefore, I think social connection is in some ways the most important pillar of lifestyle medicine. They're all important, but that's way up there. And I would say if someone who's listening has a friend who was just diagnosed, or a family member, or one of your listeners is going through breast cancer treatment herself or himself, reaching out to loved ones, friends, family for support is so key and just as important as all the things we've talked about today. So that would be my last message.
Oh, thank you so much, Amy. I think that you have such breadth of knowledge. I feel like there's so many levels of detail that we could get into on so many aspects of cancer care and treatment. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for all the information that you shared.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all the work you do. It's such an honor to be here with you, and I love your podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.